The order, first order line of business. We have chairs that are set on the first rows. They have little reserve signs. We have work groups that I need to have access to different people that may need to come in. I know there's some individuals that are sitting here. I'm going to ask you for your consideration if we need your chair to vacate it until we have the work group work done. I assure you, I see who's sitting where, which means you will get your chairs back. So we're not going to displace you for the hearing that will be happening, but first I've got to get the work session stuff done because I've got at least one member who's on a time element to leave the community, leave Salem to go to another community for hearings tonight. So with that, I assume we're going to start with Senate Bill 116, so I'll call a work session to order on Senate Bill 116. Ms. Braun, if you get us started, and then whoever needs to, if we can also get whoever the work group individuals for each of the bills to come on in so we can save time. That way we'll get to the hearing. We'll move people through a lot quicker. And let's see, Senator Deckard is here. I'm not sure if you're going to start off this presentation or if we wanted someone else, however you want to do it.
Senator Deckard should speak first.
Okay, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon, members of the committee. Ryan Deckert, State Senator from Washington County. You have my written testimony before you, but I am here to just very much endorse and give you just a brief personal experience, not personal, but constituent experience with an issue that Dylan Ardonius from my office, seated to my left, and worked with Senator Gordley's and the Attorney General's office on, and that is a testimony that this committee has heard a great deal about, and that is the very bad experience that I think it may rank into the thousands of Oregonians who have had this very bad experience with towing industry. And so I lay out in my testimony some of those experiences of constituents of mine who came to me over and over again asking for the state to step in and do something to get this industry a little more accountable to the public. And I believe that is the intention of the chair and this committee, is to really address that issue head on, both in Senate Bill 116, and I think there's two other bills, one from my office and one from Senator Gordley's office, that are teed up for next week. So all I would ask is that you might look at the testimony and the experiences of some of the folks that live in my community, and then thank this committee for taking up what I think is an issue that is really plaguing too many Oregonians. And I think this Senate action and the legislative action will really benefit many, many families in Oregon. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Senator, are you going to need to take on some other business? I was wondering if we should direct any questions to you now, or did you want to allow?
You know, Dylan Ardonius in my office has worked this with the Attorney General, and so I'm actually not really that helpful. But I'm happy to stay.
Well, it's up to you. I just want to make sure that if you need to leave, I'm going to allow individuals, if anyone had a question specifically for Senator Decker, to go ahead and ask it now. And if not, you're free to leave whenever you'd like. And we'll continue the testimony on the work session stuff.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I would just like to thank Senator Deckard for the work that our two offices have been able to do collaboratively. Dylan, you've been wonderful to work with, and again, just really appreciate the work that's been accomplished today. Thank you so much.
All right. Ryan, thank you very much. All right, so why don't we go ahead and do we want to bring the dash twos in and then have more discussion? Because I'm not sure exactly what we need to do at this point in the way of any additional statements.
Mr. Chair, Eva Novick from the Department of Justice is here to take us through the dash two amendments, which are the product of a work group. I'll just say that Senate Bill 116 is the towing bill that we remember we listened to on January 22nd. So there's been a work group since then, and there is a minimal fiscal impact and no revenue impact. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you. Eva, why don't you go ahead and walk us through what the dash twos are intended to accomplish, and we'll move from there.
Sure. For the record, my name is Eva Novick. I am an Assistant Attorney General in the Financial Fraud Consumer Protection Section of the Oregon Department of Justice. Mr. Chair, do you want me to just go through the Dash 2 amendments, or do you want me to also talk about the work group itself?
Why don't you just give us a brief overview of who was in the work group, how it, you know, how it accomplished its work, and then summarize on the amendments as to what it is. And if I have any specific questions, we'll let members ask at that time.
Okay. So, Chair Pozanski and members of the committee, I will update you on both the towing work group and briefly go through what the Dash 2 amendments are going to do. And I will just note that the Dash 1 amendments are very similar to the Dash 2 amendments, but Legislative Council made some minor drafting revisions in the Dash 2 amendments. The work group includes representatives from the legislature, the towing industry, the insurance industry, property managers and landlords, the Oregon State Police, the City of Portland, an automobile road service organization, the Department of Transportation, as well as the Oregon Department of Justice. Many of those work group members are here today, and I think that they are probably in the alternate site. The work group has been working together to discuss issues raised by SB 116 as well as other issues related to the towing industry. The group met for more than 6 hours in person and communicated further by email in January and in February. The group reached consensus on many issues, and the product of the work group appears in the Dash 2 amendments. These amendments address all issues raised in the work group except for those dealing specifically with a landlord-tenant relationship and changes to the lien laws. The Dash 2 amendments are basically a gut and stuff of the original bill, so it should be a little easier to follow. Section 1, the legislative findings, is a new section that was added by Legislative Council. A few technical changes were made in Section 3 to address concerns by the towing industry and AAA. These changes do not substantively change the intent of the bill. An addition was also made that requires towers to provide change if a tower accepts cash as a method of payment. Section 4, again, has some technical changes that do not substantively change the intent of the bill. It also includes an alternate notice requirement if the owner or operator of the motor vehicle is not present at the time of the tow, or if that person contacts the tower or requested the tow. Section 5 amends the timeline as to when and how a person can retrieve a motor vehicle or personal property of an emergency nature from a motor vehicle. It also adds that emergency nature requirement. Section 6 was added at the request of the towers and insurance companies. It clarifies how a tower can release a motor vehicle to an insurance company. Section 7 adds two exceptions to when written information needs to be provided to consumers. Both of these requests were made by industry and were accepted by the work group. Sections 9 through 14 correct some inconsistencies and confusing language in current law. For example, there were some references to motor vehicle and other references to vehicle, and those terms are defined differently under the law. The term vehicle encompasses more than the term motor vehicle encompasses. Sections 9 through 14 amend ORS Chapter 98 to make all applicable references to just vehicles. It also deletes some requirements that are currently placed on garage keepers or public parking operators and places those requirements on towers, who are the ones who, in the real world, are currently doing what is asked by the statute. And all of these changes were agreed upon in the work group. Section 9 also amends the definition of proscribed property. The work group believes that this definition makes more sense than the current definition in ORS 98805. It also deletes the distinction between parking lots with more than 10 and less than 10 parking spaces, and instead refers to parking at a single-family residential dwelling or duplex. At the request of the towers, Section 16 now places a requirement on towers to obtain a certificate of insurance rather than to just certify to the Department of Transportation, DMV, that they have insurance. This means that DMV would be notified if a tower's insurance lapses. DMV has reviewed this new requirement and will not be opposing it. I believe that there are some resources that it will take to implement the new requirement, but the fiscal is, as the committee administrator said, not significant. I would be glad to answer any specific questions regarding SB 116 or the Dash 2 amendments. I do also want to note that earlier today there was another drafting error that was noted on page 6 in lines 9 and 10. And the work group agreed that a tower could charge a gate fee during non-business hours, including on holidays. And the way that it's drafted currently, it does not talk about weekends. And so we do need to fix that little error, but it's something which can probably be fixed on the House side because there is consensus. It's just a drafting error.
All right. Questions regarding the Dash 2s for the Assistant Attorney General? Senator Beyer.
Just simply, you said that the work group reached consensus on many issues, and this is the product of it. Were there some issues that in this draft that were not agreed to by members of the work group?
No, there are no issues in this draft. There were some issues that the work group discussed and were not included.
But those are not included in this draft.
Correct.
Thank you. Anything else? All right. If not, then the chair will entertain a motion on the Dash 2s for Senate Bill 116. Senator Gordley?
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 2 amendments into Senate Bill 116.
Senator Gordley moves the Dash 2 amendments into Senate Bill 116. Is there any further discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator.
Thank you very much. I have some comments that I would like to put on the record. First, let me acknowledge the hard work and leadership of Ms. Eva Novick. Your work has been spectacular. Don't leave town. My interest in this legislation arises from the many dozens of complaints related to predatory patrol towing practices that my office has received during the past 2 years and continues to receive today. And I am aware, and we heard in testimony, that the majority of Oregon towing companies do not practice patrol towing. We have received no complaints regarding any towing issues other than those stemming from patrol towing, a practice made illegal in many other states, including California and Washington. These complaints describe a segment of an otherwise mostly well-run industry, but that is out of control and badly in need of regulation that we must enact this session. To underscore the need for this legislation addressing the towing industry, I want to note for the record that Sean Cruz, my chief of staff, returned home from a trip to Washington, D.C. last Sunday evening to discover that his vehicle had been illegally, meaning by trespassing on his private property, towed from his driveway by a patrol towing company hired by a neighboring property owner for the fourth time. After having trespassed on his property 5 in the morning, taken his vehicle, might say stolen his vehicle, the towing company sergeants demanded $235 for its release, and although they eventually returned Mr. Cruz's vehicle to its former position the next day without charge, the incident again illustrates the need for a comprehensive approach to regulating towing, including banning patrol towing in Oregon. Senate Bill 431, which addresses directly the issue of patrol towing, is scheduled to be heard in this committee on April 23rd. I say that for the record and to make the linkage between the measure before us, 116, and the opportunity that we'll have in the bill coming to us on the 23rd. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you. Any other comments or discussions?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Beyer.
Just simply say that normally I don't agree with moving forward with what we know is flawed amendments, but in this case we are getting near the end of time to work on Senate bills, so it probably would be appropriate to do that.
Yeah, thank you, Senator Beyer. I agree. If we had, let's say, more time, my understanding is everyone in the work group noticed that there's a what's called a topographical type of error that everyone has agreed needs to be fixed. It's my understanding that everyone is willing for this to go forward with that understanding, and so I appreciate that. So if there's no other discussion, any objection to the adoption of the dash twos into Senate Bill 116? Not hearing any, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 116 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Gordley moves Senate Bill 116 as amended by the dash two amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any objection? So ordered. And we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 116, and we're going to go to... And Senator Gordley, would you be so kind to be the carrier on this bill?
Happy to.
All right. I was hoping you would.
I thought you would.
And so that will be ordered. I think we need to move this one, but I don't know if they're going to tell us on that one. So we're going to open up a work session on Senate Bill 464. And... allow the individuals who need to, let's see, I guess, Ms. Brown, why don't you go ahead and go over what those amendments are.
Senate Bill 464 creates the crime of aggravated identity theft as a Class B felony. We heard this on February 12th. The committee will remember there were a few concerns at the hearing, and those concerns, the people who raised the concerns met in a work group, and the dash three amendments are the result of the work group, and they all concur in the dash three amendments. It has no revenue impact, and it has minimal fiscal impact. The dash three amendments, they clarify that the identity theft threshold of 10 or more pieces of personal identification is for 10 or more different people, and deletes the references to the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission. And I believe Craig Prinz is here, if not in the there yet, if we have any questions about the work group or the dash three amendments or the fiscal impact, which is minimal. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you. So let me just ask committee if we want to get Mr. Prince to come up, or if not, then I'm going to go ahead and take a motion on the dash threes.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash three amendments in the Senate Bill 464.
Senator Barr moves the dash three amendments into Senate Bill 464. Is there any discussion on the motion? Any objection? It's so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 464 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Barr moves Senate Bill 464 as amended by the dash three amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any further discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And does anyone want to volunteer to carry this one?
Sure.
Senator Barr will be the carrier on Senate Bill 464.
Yeah.
And if I didn't, I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 464, and I'm going to go ahead and open the work session on Senate Bill 583.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 583 is the identity theft bill. Today we have several amendments in front of us, and the dash 2 incorporates all the dash 1 amendments and adds some, and I can go into the details on that. And we also have in front of you today the dash 4 amendment, which is new today, and I don't know if you can find it on your desk. We have a lot of paper in front of us. Let me get to the page. It's under page 4 of the bill. It's section 7. Subsection 7 under Section 3, and it changes the wording for the likely harm to individuals to determines that no reasonable likelihood of harm to the individuals whose personal information has been acquired has resulted or will result from the breach. Mr. Chair, I can go into detail on the Dash 2 amendments. It's my understanding the Dash 3 amendments are no longer being considered at this time. And at this point, there's no revenue impact, and the fiscal impact statement is still being worked on. It's expected to be minimal.
All right, thank you. Regarding, let's see, I guess we'll take this in order of amendments, the dash two amendments. The chair will take a motion on the dash two amendments.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash two amendments in the Senate Bill 583.
Senator Barr moves the dash two amendments into Senate Bill 583. Any discussion regarding those amendments? Any objection? They will be so ordered. And let's see, then regarding the dash four amendments.
I'm trying to catch up. Are we talking about dash threes too, or eight?
No, the dash threes are not going to be considered. My understanding, the parties have worked out the resolution on that.
Okay.
And because of that, we're now moving into the dash fours.
Okay. And I should mention, Mr. Chair, the dash five amendments are also on your desk, and those have been presented just right before the meeting. So.
Okay.
They deal with the same issue, Mr. Chair.
They deal with the same issue as the dash fours.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash four amendments into Senate Bill 583.
All right. Senator Barr moves the dash four amendments into Senate Bill 583. Any discussion? Senator Monroe?
Yeah, these are designed, are they to further define what is meant by the word harm? Is that correct?
That is correct. What we're moving from is, let's call it a subjective test to an objective test. I met with the lobbyist representing LexisNexis and their representative on Monday. They brought to my attention this as one of their issues at that time. They also provided me with material from what other states had used. Based on the review of that material, I chose to go with the model that is being used in the state of Arkansas. And I thought that that was one that seemed to be favored as to the reasonable likelihood of harm. And based on the work groups over the 9 months periods of putting together the bill that we have, it seemed to be much more in sync than with other suggestions that had come from other states. But it will, in fact, shift it away from what some people may interpret it to be a subjective test to a more objective test, and the chair is fine with that.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I can understand some concern because some people might think that, you know, things like, gee, mental anguish or something like that is harm. And I think what we intend here is real harm, financial harm or the abuse of a person's ID or, you know, for fraudulent purposes or something of that nature. And does this amendment define that correctly or make that very clear? I want it on the record. We're talking about real harm, not just somebody that has bad feelings because they were on some list that got inadvertently lost.
Yeah, and I guess, Senator Monroe, what I would recommend is, or what I would say is that the definition that will be adopted will be more of what's referred to and relied on within our law as a reasonable person's test. So it would be judged based on what individuals such as peers and a jury would decide. And I wouldn't go so far to say, quote unquote, real harm as compared to something that can be demonstrated and determined by the trier of fact that something has occurred as compared to, because when we get into using the terms of what's real, what's not real, I'm a little bit more hesitant as compared to using the body of law that has been established through our judicial system as to what would be under the objective test of reasonableness, which is more in line with what your peers would determine to be reasonable as compared to what the individual claiming the harm may believe.
Okay, so the reasonable person test is the key ingredient here. Thank
yes.
you.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Well, I think I'd also like to, besides the reasonable person test, you've also got the phrase that will result from the breach.
Right.
And I think that, I mean, legislative intent needs to say that basically we're talking about harm from identity theft or breach of a database. So it's very clear that it's not harm from, you know, some other reason, but it's harm from a breach of a database is what we're talking about.
That's correct. When you look at the amendment, as it will be a substituted language, which says determines that no reasonable likelihood of harm to the individuals whose personal information has been acquired has resulted or will result from the breach. So my response to Senator Monroe was just talking about the standard of the test, but clearly, Senator Beyer, that standard of the test will have to be applied to information, personal information that's acquired, and whether it has in fact resulted or will result in some type of harm from the breach.
Thank you.
All right. Any other points that we want to put on the record? If not, any objection to the adoption of the Dash 4 amendments in the Senate Bill 583? Not hearing any, it will be so ordered, and the Chair will entertain a motion now to move the bill to the floor.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 583 is amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Beyer moves Senate Bill 583 as amended by the Dash 2s as well as the Dash 4s to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any further discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And I'll go ahead and carry this one on the floor. And we're going to stand down and recess for about 2 minutes, and so we'll be at ease.
And I didn't hear what you said when you were whispering in my ear.
So if I can have everyone's attention, I'm going to do a change of course here right now. We had one other bill that we were planning on working in work session today, which is Senate Bill 780. We will not be having the work session today, and we will be taking that matter up more than likely next week. With that said, we're moving into now the public hearing, which I think many of the individuals are here today, and that is calling a public hearing on Senate Bill 858. And Ms. Braun, why don't you give us the overview on that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 858 allows adult foster care providers to collectively bargain with the state. It has a Dash 2 amendment, and the committee doesn't have that yet, I believe.
It was in our packet.
Oh, it wasn't. Oh, excellent. The Dash 2 amendment further defines what adult foster care provider means, and this bill has no revenue impact. I don't know about the fiscal impact yet. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Thank you very much. We have a number of people who want to give testimony today. And in fact, we have so many people, I can assure you, there is no way that we're going to have everyone testify today. So what we're going to do is this. First of all, I'm going to ask everyone who does give testimony today to be as short and as concise as you can. There will be two panels that are going to come up at the very beginning. This is somewhat of our traditional way of dealing with these issues and making certain that we have the framework for the proponents as well as the opponents to the bill. Myself and Ms. Braun will go through the stack of people who want to testify on 858, and we will decide from, we'll look at it and see who's over 100 miles from here. When you come up to give testimony, I'm going to ask you for a couple of things. Number one, to pare your testimony down to no more than 2 minutes. If you have written material that you'll be handing in, please do not read from that. Speak from the heart. Let me and the committee know how you feel about it. We can read your testimony, and we will read your testimony before we take any action on the bill. And if you've already heard your testimony been given by someone else, one of two things you can do. If you want to come up and put your name on the record and say, I support what other people have said, so be it. If you want to just pass and wave and let someone else testify, that will be appreciative as well. I want to make certain everyone understands, again, with this many people that have signed up, there's no way that we're going to be able to hear everyone today. I have one senator that's probably going to be leaving here close to 4:30. So she can be on the road to be in a hearing in Eugene that is scheduled for Ways and Means. So I will have individuals peeling off as the afternoon continues, and I will be closing the hearing at 4:45 today. So with that said, Art Towers, Arthur, you're coming up. Do you have a panel of one or two people you want to be your proponent panel? Okay, so I got Mr. Towers, I got Mr. Bischoff, and who else?
We'll start.
Okay. And then let me tell you, the next panel I'm going to have will be an opponent panel, which is going to be Grover and is it Jess, I believe, Mr. Smith?
Les,
excuse me. All right, gentlemen, whoever wants to go forward, and again, remember, you have a lot of individuals who would like to give testimony after you, so if you can frame it, that'd be great.
Chair Prezanski, for the record, my name is Don Bischoff. I'm Legislative Assistant to Senator Bill Morissette. He's in his own committee at this hour and is not able to be here. He's asked me to provide you with his strong endorsement of Senate Bill 858, which he thinks will go a long way towards correcting some of the short changing that the adult foster home care providers in the state have suffered over the years. Just one example, I think, perhaps illustrates part of the problem that these folks have suffered. For two sessions now, Senator Morissette has tried to has sponsored bills to allow adult foster home care providers to buy into one of the state insurance health insurance pools. That has been fought strongly by the managers of these pools on the grounds that adult foster care home providers tend to be older and therefore suffer more injuries and illnesses, and it would drive up the costs of the pools, so they didn't want them in there. So the irony is that because they need something, they can't get it as far as the state's concerned. Senator Morissette believes that if Senate Bill 858 had been law, and these folks had a union to argue their case for them, that they would probably be insured today. He believes that the experience of home care workers in the state is an example of how people can be helped in their dealings with the state in taking care of some of the more people who suffer from various problems and who are state wards. And I'll just sum it up by saying that Senator Morissette believes that allowing these folks to have union representation and all the benefits that come with it is something that that they sorely need. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Prezanski, members of the committee, my name is Arthur Towers, and I'm Political Director for Service Employees Union Local 503. And thank you very much for the opportunity to testify today, and thanks to Senator Morissette for bringing this bill forward. Senate Bill 858 seeks to strengthen the quality of care for elderly and frail Oregonians by providing adult foster care providers the right to bargain collectively. I'll touch for a moment on the nature of the work and then discuss how the bill works. Adult foster care providers care for five or fewer adults who are physically disabled or mentally ill or developmentally disabled in a home-like environment. There are about 2,600 of those providers across the state. We're thrilled that more than half of them, between 1,400 and 1,500, have signed cards to express their interest in joining with us in SEIU. Oregon's long been a leader in terms of allowing frail residents to live with independence and dignity, yet the adult foster home program is a relatively weak link in the continuum of care. Monthly Medicaid reimbursement rates range from $725 per month per client to $1,645 per month per client. In other settings, caregivers have worked to improve the quality of care by improving training programs, establishing a registry of care providers so that it's easier for those in need to find a caregiver. They've worked to improve working conditions and wages so that turnover has been reduced significantly. And they've also worked to protect client choice so that clients can continue to choose who provides their care. In terms of what Senate Bill 858 does, is it allows adult foster home workers with a direct financial relationship with the state to bargain collectively. Adult foster home providers receive a payment from the state, and those would be the workers who would be eligible to collectively bargain. The Dash 2 amendments carve out some providers, and those are the handful of providers, probably about 40 or 50 providers, who operate on a different scale. For example, a county that operates a foster care home, a hospital that operates a foster care home, those would not be covered under the bill. Section 2, paragraph 1B of the Dash 2 amendments addresses that. Adult foster home providers occasionally hire a relative or somebody else to help them. Our research shows, again, there are about 2,600 providers, about 500 resident managers or shift or substitute caregivers. Again, it's the providers who have a financial relationship with the state that we're working with here. again, the situation for these caregivers is pretty dire. They have it in their heart to provide this sort of care, and our goal is to make sure they don't have to take a vow of poverty to do that, and in turn they can improve the quality of care to do the work they wanted to devote themselves to. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you. All right, let me make a couple of comments. I know some people may not agree with the testimony that's given. I will not tolerate anyone making comments while another person's testifying. I will have you removed from the room. We're here to hear the testimony. I respect you. I want you to respect the people that give us testimony as much as you want to be respected when you give testimony. With that, thank you very much. Let's continue.
Senator Prozanski and committee members, I'm Gary Lane. I run a foster home for mental health in Lane County and have done so since 1992. I'm also president of Adult Care Providers of Oregon. And the bottom line is this bill will give foster care providers the right to vote for or against being part of a union. And providers for a long time, as has been summarized, have tried to get various things through legislature or through the Department of Health Services in terms of rules, regulations, pay, equal pay for equal work, which actually was passed by this group, by the legislature years ago and then rescinded when the state ran into financial problems. We're in favor of the right for foster care providers to decide whether or not they can have a union. At this state, our condition is we aren't eligible to have a union or any kind of representation. All we're asking for is the right for all the providers to vote for or against it, and this bill will allow us to do that.
All right, thank you. Questions for this panel? Senator Vire first.
Thank you. If this bill is to pass, and you said out of 2,600, you have approximately 1,400 or 1,500, and those somewhere between 11 or 1,200 providers who have not signed cards, would they be forced to join the union?
Chair Prozanski, Vice Chair Beyer, it would work the same as any other union election or selection process where people would have the chance to join or not join, and membership would be totally open, just like it is with our state workers. State workers need to provide pay a service fee for the right of representation. But they're not required to join the union.
So even the people who would not want to participate in the union would have to pay for the union.
Chair Prozanski, Vice Chair Beyer, the members of the workers in this bargaining unit who would benefit from the collective bargaining would indeed have to pay a fee.
So I just want to be very clear. These are not workers. These are independent business people. And these independent business people would be forced to pay a fee to an organization they don't support and don't want to belong to.
Chair Prozanski, Senator Beyer, arrangement would be the way I just laid it out.
The way I laid it out or you laid it out?
I think we've been pretty close in agreement.
Okay.
Well, let me just make sure I'm not confused here. It's my understanding that if a unit decides to organize and they are accepted and they move forward, everyone that is covered within that collective bargaining, whether they want to be part of the union or not, are going to have to pay some type of a quote-unquote service fee or something into that representation on the theory that they receive some benefit from that representation.
Chair Prozanski, in that sort of circumstance, then the union still has the responsibility to represent those workers. Yes.
I guess another question on that line, Mr. Chair. What about the money that is deducted, taken for political purposes by the union?
Chair Prozanski, Senator Beyer, fee that's paid is for the cost of representation, not the cost of the electoral work or the cost of other political work.
So just to be clear, there would be no checkoff so that the union would automatically deduct wages for political purposes in addition to those for providing service to the union?
Chair Prozanski, Senator Beyer, that's correct.
Any other questions for this panel? Senator Lockyer.
I just after this series of questions from both senators. I just want to make sure that I'm clear and the record's clear. You're not doing anything in this bill that is any... this whole discussion had to do with what's already existing in state law, not anything that's new in this bill, correct?
Senator Przanski, Senator Vakian, that's correct.
Okay.
Any other questions?
Well, now I am confused. Because there, there is a checkoff program that that members who belong to the union are required to do unless they affirmatively choose to do something else with the dollars. For political purposes, the dollars are used for to go into the union political fund.
All right. Let me do this. The chair is going to use the prerogative. One, I'm going to ask Ms. Braun to research this. And Mr. Towers, I want to give you one last opportunity to try to set something on the record. But after that, I'm going to move on because we've got a lot of people here that I want to try to get as many in to testify. So you want one more shot, or you want to let it stand?
I'll let it pass. And let
all right. We'll let the heavy lifting be done by Ms. Braun, our trusted administrator, who will get us the answers. Thank you. Gentlemen, thank you very much for your time. All right, the next panel I have, which are representing the opponents, will be Les Smith and Grover Simmons.
What does the bill say?
And did you have one other person that you wanted to bring up, just the two of you? And Mr. Smith, thank you very much for being here today. I understand you're going to want to give us somewhat of a presentation. I assume that all the members will be receiving your paper on the subject. I received one this morning. I have not had a chance to get through it all. But what I'm going to ask you to do, again, with many people here on both sides of the issue who want to give testimony, frame it, summarize it, and let us move forward because we do have all that. And what we can do is, if necessary, bring you back for more questions or work through the administrator to answer questions that the committee may have.
By way of background, I am a former National Labor Relations Board attorney,
right.
And I practice labor law in Portland now for over 30 years. My purpose is really to talk about what looks like a very amazing, clearly flawed bill, because I'm hearing where folks want to be part of a union, and under the current setting, they certainly can be. Not only would the foster care homes, regardless of their size, be subject to union organization, and the people who work in there be union members, and by being union members, they could pay and they could get the insurance. There's no question about that, because the foster care homes, the adult foster care homes, are covered either by the National Labor Relations Act under the guidelines that are set forth by the National Labor Relations Board, or they are covered under 663005, which is the little National Labor Relations Act that covers all what we normally refer to as the mom-and-pop size organizations that don't meet the jurisdictional standards of the National Labor Relations Board. So I'm really lost in regard to that. The other is that this proposed legislation appears to try to take those who are the entities, those who own these businesses, those who may be LLCs, they may be DBAs, they may be Chapter S, they may be corporations, they may not be anything. But in any event, they are a person in the context of what the law recognizes for purposes of jurisdictional issues that the federal scheme passed through the National Labor Relations Act was envisioned to reach out to. And if not, again, the state law is already in place for that. The problem becomes is that if the state steps into the shoes of the federal government where they're already in place with the National Labor Relations Act and these jurisdictional standards, what it does is it makes the state law null and void, maybe unconstitutional, whatever, under a doctrine that's long been recognized and is known as the preemption doctrine. In other words, if the state goes into an area that's already picked up on by the feds, then that law passed by the state, which changes what's the more or less norm for the country, is going to be preempted. And there are lots of cases that hold and find this. Now, I want to talk just quickly about the jurisdictional guidelines and standards. I've set that forth in my paper that I presented. There's a variety of standards for different types of businesses throughout the country. And there are standards for healthcare organizations. But there's an underlying standard that makes almost every employer, unless they're truly public, come under the National Labor Relations Act and the jurisdiction of the NLRB, and that's the $50,000 and the interstate commerce concept. And $50,000 means doing business in the state with somebody who in turn is in interstate commerce. It may even mean that the money that comes across the borders that goes and helps the foster care homes now is part of that. And the cases that I've cited in my position make it very clear that what would sometimes look very much like a public entity, a city hospital or county hospital or whatever, is in fact still under the jurisdiction of the National Labor Relations Board because of the National Labor Relations Act. So in a way, what this bill does is trying to grab a group of employers, small business, independent employers, and changing their status from being employer to employee, and doing it only for the limited purposes of the state in order to allow a collective group of entities to then be able to be part of a union, which makes no sense at all. That'd be the same as passing a bill here that would capture restaurant owners or restaurant managers, whatever it might be, or building owners. How about a firm of attorneys? If the state stepped in and said, we think for the limited purposes of collective bargaining, we're going to make this group be able to bargain and have a statewide unit. It's exactly the same thing, because each and every one of these entities, whatever they are, DBA, corporation, or otherwise, still has to be viewed as such. And that's the real nugget of the problem here. It's good intention, I guess, to be able to help folks who need to get help. But really, the union is here for them now. All they have to do is take one of the smaller entities in Salem, wherever it is, wherever it might be located. They go see the union. They say, look, we want to get our people part of the union. How about representing our facility? And so they get together and they sign a collective bargaining agreement. They sign the collective bargaining agreement. Under that is the union's health care program. It's a Taft-Hartley Trust, which the employer contributes into, and the union. In other words, it's there so that they can have coverage. It's exactly the same program that won on this broader basis. It's not any different. So it really doesn't matter what size it is, whether it's state level under 663005 or whether it's under the jurisdiction of the National Labor Relations Act. What they want is already available to them.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, do we have the written testimony
from
Mr. Smith?
I just asked.
I've got copies of it.
That includes your analysis on the Supremacy Clause?
It does. Okay. Supremacy and the Commerce Clause, everything.
So, Mr. Smith, if you have extra copies, that'd be wonderful for us to have. If not, I'll have Ms. Braun.
No,
make
I have
available
them right here.
Okay.
So,
wonderful. Simmons, did you want to...
I'm done. Oh, unless you have questions.
Well, I was going to ask if anyone had any questions. Why don't we do this? Mr. Simmons, why don't you go ahead and give us your testimony. Again, we have your written stuff. You'll summarize. We'll then open up for questions.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Robert Simmons. I represent the licensed adult foster home providers who are members of the Independent Adult Foster Home Association. And I might, as an aside, indicate that it's been my honor to represent foster homes in the Capitol for well over 20 years. So nice to be back. Our association is opposed to Senate Bill 858, and we respectfully urge the committee to hold this bill in committee and do not pass it to the Senate floor. There are three reasons for our opposition. First, as an association, we're relying on the counsel of our lawyer, who has a position paper to hand out. And his bottom line point is that this whole bill is preempted by the National Labor Relations Act. And that act is grounded on the Supremacy Clause and the Commerce Clause of the United States Constitution. In his written testimony, and he does have 15 copies for the committee, he alludes to 16 different cases that are cited in the notes in support of the fact that SB 858 would not hold up in court if tested. We hope the committee will study Les's written testimony and give it very careful consideration. The second reason for our opposition deals with the concept of fair share, which Senator Beyer alluded to earlier on in the discussion. as it appears in a standard union contract. Now, union organizers are going all throughout Oregon and all parts of the state, visiting adult foster homes, soliciting authorization cards. They want to get signed authorization cards. And they're handing out materials, including copies of a document entitled Home Care Workers Second Contract. And you have, each of you has a copy of that contract. This is being handed out at the door to members of our association and adult foster home providers. The very last page, page 11, I want to call your attention to, if I may. The second part, it says, what is fair share? And they describe that. This document is being handed out, and it discusses the in-home care workers contract, which was negotiated 4 years. They reorganized 4 years ago, I believe. And it alludes to that contract regularly, and they say, this is what we can do for you. So they are proposing this document to our providers at their home, and part of what they're talking about is this fair share concept. So it's being offered as a model for what may occur in this adult foster home organization drive. On that paragraph that I've alluded to, it explains that anyone who is in the bargaining unit who refuses to join the union must nevertheless pay a fee to the union which is equal to the union dues. And the union dues in their document is $1.70 per $100 of gross earnings. So that's where we get two figures that are significant to this organization drive. The fact that you have to pay a fair share if you don't belong and don't want to belong, and secondly, the rate of pay is equal to the union dues at 1.7%. So you apply the 1.7% to the average gross earnings of a foster home caring for five Medicaid residents. That would generate a monthly dues of over $150 a month. And even providers who care for only private pay residents, no Medicaid, and who do not wish to join the union would still have to pay this fee because they are in the bargaining unit, and the union has a right to represent them. And SB 858 defines the bargaining unit as all adult foster care providers in the state. Now, the Dash 2 amendment attempts to reduce the coverage, I believe. I got the amendment about 30 minutes or so before today's meeting, but I think they're trying to reduce the coverage by alluding to those providers who receive money from the state, that is, care for Medicaid residents. But the bargaining unit is defined in the proposed bill itself as the entire state. And the Department of Human Services tells me there are 1,691 adult foster homes in Oregon. You multiply that number by the estimated monthly union dues, and you get $3,052,407 per year. $3,052,000 a year in union dues. Extracting that amount of money from an industry of small business owners seems overwhelming. I have used my time, but there's a whole other chapter that we need to discuss somewhere along the line, and it deals with the fact that there's an effort, I believe, an undercurrent effort to accomplish the unionization of the adult foster homes without an election, without an election supervised by the National Labor Relations Board and conducted with a secret ballot. Now, that's the model that was used by the child care bill, and I visited with the people who represent the children's industry, children's caregiving industry, and they confirmed, yes, no election. Well, I think that flies in the face of what we really ought to be standing for. Anyway, I've used my time, and I thank you for your time.
All right, thank you. Any questions for either of our witnesses? Gentlemen, thank you very much for your time. All right, we're going to start off. I had two people that checked off boxes that said they're 100 miles away or further. I want to confirm that before I call them up, because one of them actually lists Clackamas as being their location. I just want to make sure that's not like Clackamas, Texas, or something like that. Valora de la Delina, maybe? Hard to read. I think it's D-E-H-L-L-E-A-N. All right, and she's not from... she's from Clackamas, like up the road? Okay. All right, so she can wait. Then I had Harry Snyder. Mr. Snyder? Not seeing Mr. Snyder. Okay, we're going to go at the top. All right. Mr. Snyder, where are you from, sir? Come on up. That's a bingo. All right. So I've got... And I'm going to call two other people up. I'm going to try to do pros and cons, but since Mr. Snyder is over 100 miles and he's in the against position, let's go ahead and call up. Mm-hmm. Read that.
Smith?
I don't know. It really helps if you put your name where we can read it. Dorothy Caldwell, if you'll come up and.
Petrarelli?
Petronella.
That's the first name, Petronella.
Okay, whoever is that, if you want to come up and give testimony, that'd be great too. All right, Mr. Snyder, you get to go first.
My name is Harry Snyder. I'm the executive director of the Adult Family Care Providers in Southern Oregon. We've been in existence for over 10 years. We do education for providers, provide assistance in protective service issues, and have been dealing with the state and bringing measures to make our business a better business. We are adamantly opposed to this bill. And on that paper I passed out, we only had a short period of time to get signatures to that those people I represent said I could go ahead and speak for them, that they are opposed to the situation. I get many calls from people that supposedly have signed the cards and then having trouble understanding what they signed, and they're calling me as to what they signed and what it means. I don't know how we're going to verify these 1,800 signatures or so that they're collecting or trying to collect. Many people are not understanding or being misled in what they're being told it would be about. My situation here today is I'm here to advocate for seniors. If we remember back in the old biennium, when Governor Gitzhopper was in office, we had a situation that came about when we did get some rights and we were going to get some better collective bargaining situation, and then we got in trouble by the federal government. There was many reasons. Under the federal waiver, 1915C, the home and community-based waiver, I hate to see that same thing happen again for the people that we take care of. I'm trying to talk really fast here because I know my time is limited. Many more things. I sent all of the emails prior to. I hope you got them all. I'd be glad to do anything else afterwards. But the Medicaid system, the way it exists now in the state of Oregon, is a delicate situation financially. Do we want more? Sure. But there's a process in which we can do it without going through this process and being a burden upon foster home providers.
All right. Thank you. And if you want to go next, if you can kind of pull the mic down, just make sure we get you recorded. That'd be wonderful. Doesn't that be real close to you?
Okay. My name is Dorothy Caldwell. I've been a provider and a advocate for the seniors and the foster home industry for 30 years. I started out in 1980. I've worked up both at legislative level and have had 5 homes of my own. This action will put such a burden on the providers that are already struggling to stay into business that it's just totally out of reason. It doesn't do anything for the providers of Oregon. It only helps the union. Many I do work with a large community of Romanian people. Most of them have called me and told me they signed these cards thinking that they were going to get all these benefits and that the state was going to pay for them. When they realized that as time went by and they got more information that they're going to be paying for it, then they wanted to know how they could get the cards back. And I said, that I don't know, but I will mention it when I do go to Salem. You will hear the same thing that I have just said 100 times. So I will stop at this point and just beg you not to pass this.
Thank you. If you go ahead and state your name now for the record and give us your testimony.
I guess Mr. Chair is gone, but Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Petronella Donovan, and I am a Romanian, and I am also a provider in Clackamas County and have my own adult foster care home. And I share the views of many of the providers. We are opposed of this. A lot of the providers did not understand what they were signing when the union members came out to our homes. Several of them came several times and told us they were going to do give us better wages as far as Medicaid goes. And we understood that they were going to be paying for this, but we were talking here, the money's coming from our pockets. Some of us are struggling, have 2 Medicaid clients, we can barely pay the bills now, but then having to pay union dues and other fees on top of that, there's no way that these adult care homes can stay afloat. We are respectfully would hope that you would consider not passing this to the Senate floor.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you very much for your testimony today, and thank you for coming up from Medford. Okay, Chris Thornock, Ginny Grinswick, Gary Lane already testified? Did Gary Lane already testify? Gary Lane? Okay, Sonia.
Rickline?
Okay. All right, Chris, go ahead and start off whenever you're ready. Give us your name for the record and your testimony.
Hi, my name is Christine Thornock. Currently, for the last 3 years, I own an adult foster care home in Forest Grove, Oregon. Next month, I'm opening up a new one in Hillsboro. They're level 3 homes, which means I work with hospice and terminally ill people. And I'm sorry, I forgot. I wanted to thank you and tell you what an honor it is to be in front of you and to be able to speak here. I'm a little distressed because every person in here, for or against this union, the system is broken with the state. Even if it's $150 a month that we have to pay to this union, you're talking about taking care of someone 24 hours a day who is up day and night, oftentimes for $1,400. I have 6 staff at one of my houses. I cannot pay my bills with that, but we do what we do because we love these people. These people have been productive members of society. They've been homeowners. They've been business owners. They're allowed $181 a month. Who picks up the slack in that? Who pays for the night care needs? It's the foster care people that are sitting here. We're all torn, and I hear that these things are available to us, a union. Well, so far, I've talked to everyone at the Department of Aging. They know who I am. I'm on that phone all the time. I'm not being heard. I'm told this is the rate. If they tell you have to take $1,400 for a client, you've got 2 choices. Take it, cancel your contract, and evict these people and they go on the street. Or they go somewhere else. They go to a nursing home. The bottom line is, I understand it. We're struggling. I hear these things are out there. I've called everyone I can think of. And I don't want to cancel my state contract. But to be honest, as a businesswoman, I am paying, I am losing money every month on state clients. So if paying $150 a month will change the way it is and allow me to give better care to these people who are allowed $181 a month. You know, they can't afford socks, they can't afford underwear, because guess what? Medicare does not pay for a lot of their prescriptions. They have to pay a pharmacy bill. So we, as providers, if we're good ones, and I'm sure even for or against this, we are. But as I stand and talk to as many people as I have, I've yet to find an option. So I am begging, because I don't want to cancel my state contract, but I do not know what else to do. I cannot afford to keep these state clients. So,
Mr. Chair, I have a question, because we've gotten some conflicting information, and I'd like to know if one of you ladies maybe can answer this, or somebody else. This piece of material that we got from an opponent of this measure indicates that fair share payment in lieu of dues could be $150 a month, but on the bottom line it says on average union dues are between $10 and $15 per month. My understanding of labor law is that fair share payments cannot exceed union dues. Can anybody respond to that? I just need to know what the number is.
That paper, I know I heard people did, but I never received it.
I can try. My name is Sonia Reichwein. I'm a member of SEIU, and I'm actually also the vice president. I think that there's some misinformation out there. If I have the chair's permission, I'm sorry, I forgot to ask.
No, you're fine.
Membership dues are 1.7%. That's true. But it's not 1.7% of your gross income. And that's where people are being misled, I think, because when I've been out all over the state talking to foster care providers, they're not paid a regular hourly wage. They're paid service fees. The majority of that money goes to take care of their clients, their residents. It does not go into their pocket. What we're looking at doing, we actually intentionally did not set up a due structure, because the intent is once foster care providers have bargaining rights, they will sit down and figure out how the dues will work for themselves. The intent is they pay something fair and equitable, but it would be based on their net income, what's left over at the end of the month, not what they're paying for their clients. One idea that's been tossed around is a flat fee per resident. Also, the members would only be those members who have contracts with the state who have actual Medicaid patients. It would not be anyone who's doing private pay beds, because those are private contracts. The fair share, and I hope I'm saying this right, the way that works is when you're fair share, the money that would have gone into politics does not go into politics. That can be returned at their request. They're paying their fair share just for representation rights, because even though they're not members, they're still benefiting. They still have access to, if we can get health insurance, they have access to that.
Let me interrupt you. Can fair share legally exceed what the union dues are for those who choose to join the union?
I'm not a legal expert. I've never seen it exceed what a member pays. It's always less. I have, or the same, and then they're rebated the political fees. I don't know where that would come from.
Now, 40 years ago, when I was an OEA rep and a young teacher, we went through the fair share arguments, and at that time, fair share could not exceed what the union dues are, and I just want to make sure that the law hasn't changed in the last 40 years. Thank you.
No, we'll get an answer to that. All right, Gina.
My name is Jenny Grinswick. I am a home care worker and adult foster care provider. I'm actually on my second license. I do short-term adult foster care for end-of-life people. The second one, though, is for my father-in-law. And without the adult foster care program, I would be living in poverty right now, because his medical alone, prescription alone, took all of his money. With the adult foster care program, I now get to save money. I can buy him clothes, the necessities that he needs. I don't have any employees. I have my husband and my brother-in-law they are my backup. In fact, they are at home today taking care of their dad. So I can be up here advocating for adult foster care organization in SEIU.
All right, thank you. Sonia, did you have anything else that you'd like to add?
Well, my intent was to read testimony from an adult foster care provider in Klamath Falls. I believe that you requested that we not do things like that, but I do have copies of the testimony for the chair and the committee and also for another foster care provider in Lebanon that I'd be happy to provide.
That would be wonderful. We'll put our records, and all of us will. We're pretty diligent in looking and reviewing the material that we get, so that would allow us to move on and let some other people testify if that was your testimony.
Although I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Yeah, I'm just going to ask if there are any questions. Senator Beyer?
I guess a couple questions. Chris, question for you. What is it you're trying to, get out of a unionization? Are you just looking for better pay for your Medicaid clients?
I'm looking for better working conditions. I'm looking for better pay, certainly, because I'm losing money on my Medicaid clients. Most of all, I'm looking for a way for all of us to band together and do something about the system, because we receive a quarter of what a nursing home receives for the same care. In fact, in most cases, it's more extreme care, to where, we are dealing with end of life in my home. We work with hospice. Often, we do 24-hour shifts. To pay the staff alone, a state client, I can't even pay one staff member with what I receive for a state client.
Just so clarification, you are the employer and you have employees.
Yes.
But you want to be the union member, not your employees.
I would like to be able to offer them health insurance. And if joining a union would do that, then, my employees, I've all agreed to it as well. I run my foster care home mostly with family members. My mother is my business partner. And I have my father working with me, my sister-in-law, and a couple of miscellaneous.
But are you aware that your employees today, without this bill, can form a union and get health insurance?
I don't know how to do that. And I've called and I've talked to the Department of Aging, and I've tried to figure out a way to do that. And that's why I was saying I heard him sit up here and talk about how to do that. But I've also talked with a lot of other foster care homes in my area, and they don't know how to do it either. I'm sure it could be done, but I don't know who to call. I don't know who to contact. And I've got five residents.
I guess I would suggest you talk to the person with two people to your left.
Okay. Any other questions?
Ladies.
May I comment or not?
What are you going to comment on? I'm just trying to figure out where we're at so we can move some other people.
On unionizing providers as opposed to caregivers.
Senator Bakken.
I have a question, and the question is to you. I'd like to know what you want to say about that. And the reason is because and I'm sorry about that, Mr. Chair, but Senator Beyer prompted the question, which is you would be the one that she would go to, and so I think it's only fair to let you provide the answer.
And once again, I'm not an expert, but my understanding is that the care providers are all paid through the state. They have a common employer. Caregivers have all these different providers as their employers. So it's beyond me how you would even go about doing that. I know that it has been done in some other states. I don't know how they've done that. We represent state employees. We see the state as their employer. So it's a natural progression to work with them. And if we can help the caregivers by unionizing the providers, that would be awesome.
Any other comments or questions?
No, we're done. We're both done.
Thank you very much.
Thank
All right, our next panel is going to be Gabriel Couch, or Koch, possibly. And I got a Stefan, and I cannot even attempt to get the last name. Taigu Lee, maybe, or Lai?
Any of those?
Okay. And
And then I'm going to go with either, is it Juta Lupa? Lupe?
It's a definitional.
All right. If you'll give us your name before you give us your testimony, and then you can go, you can get started.
I'm Gabriela Constantinescu, and I'm a care provider of adult foster home. I've been a provider for more than 13 years, and I'm here to oppose this bill.
Okay. And is there, besides just having the opposition or opposing the bill, is there something else you'd like to tell us as to why you're opposing it?
Because foster care, we are foster care, and it's very hard even to have five residents, you know, to pay the bills, and, you know, it's a lot of more foster homes are more struggling, and it will be overwhelming for the providers to pay the fee dues and all the union expenses. And I don't think it's, because even if you want health insurance, you could have health insurance by being self-employed. And I think if you could, if you manage your money, you could do without the union.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
No problem.
My name is Stefan Tigu, and I'm an owner of an adult foster home. And I go against the union. The reason is because with state clients that we have, we don't have to pay taxes for the money comes from the state. But if we belong to the union, I think we have to pay taxes for those money. And also, being a self-employed and having a small business, why do I have to go with a union? Because I'm self-employed and I can manage my business the way I want to, like other small businesses that are in Oregon, or, you know, it's more regulations and more taxes that we have to pay for, you know, belonging to a different agency.
Mr. Chair, can we get an answer to that? I don't think that's correct. I don't think there should be any difference in tax liability.
I don't know the answer, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, I don't have the answer either, but based on what I just heard, Stefan, I do not believe that's correct. But we'll try to get some more information and have that as part of the record as to just because you join a union and that you would be under some type of tax structure for the money that you'd be receiving from the state. That does not, I don't believe that's true.
Mr. Chair, he may just be thinking of union dues.
Oh, okay. Yeah, all right. Yeah. All right, thank you.
My name is Zidita Lupu. I've been a care provider for the last 15 years. I own three adult care homes, and I oppose the bill. I have three homes. I have employees. I have medical insurance for them. I think we should have the right to either join the union or not join the union. I am a Romanian. I come from a communist country, where we are told what to do all the time. I came to a free country where I would like to do what I would like to do with my business without somebody else telling me what to do. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. Again, I'm going to ask you not to show your expression of good or bad so we can move through, but I appreciate it. I know this is very emotional for everyone, and I thank you if you kind of keep it down. Any questions for our panel? Thank you very much for coming forward and giving us your testimony.
Can you guys approach supporting
this one? I'll make sure to get your name. Yeah. For the record. Yeah, that's okay. Yeah. Okay. Sorry, Fran. Next panel will be George Hahn and Mosetta Zion. And looks like Rick Bennett, why don't you come on up? Well, I'll tell you, Rick, you're you're here all the time, so instead of Rick. I've got Fred and Beth.
Asa,
it looks like. So if one of the two of you want to come up, that will be fine. So. Okay. Whoever wants to get started, that'd be great. And Fred, thank you very much for coming forward.
Thank you.
Okay. This is okay.
Chairman Przanski and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to be here. My name is George Hayen. I've been a foster care provider for 1 year. I've also got 12 years experience as a member of another union with the International Union of Painters and Allied Trades. I believe in the union. The union has been good for me and my family. Since I've had my foster care home, I've had to still work full-time doing drywall because of the fact that even with 5 Medicaid clients, by the time I paid my mortgage, my electric payments, and all the other utilities that go to running this home, and having to be there 24/7, approximately 720 hours per month that I have to have that house manned, it adds up into half of what minimum wage is. If I was to stop work and have to provide my own health insurance, I would be devastated and be working for free. So I have to keep working outside the home to provide for me and my wife. I feel also that if a union is possible through whatever means, that even those people that are not really interested in unions, unions have really made a lot of standards in American society better. When we say we want higher minimum wage, it's for the whole society. It's not just for us, and those that don't want to vote for it don't get it. It's always made, the labor movement has always been for everybody. If we were to unionize even those that don't agree with it, and we was able to raise Medicaid rates by 10-15% to help those that are struggling, all would benefit. I pay, just in the union I'm in now, I pay about $3,500 a year for the benefit to work. I make twice as much than if I was to be non-union, and I really do believe that if given the opportunity to unionize whatever way we could, that everyone will benefit, even though they don't see it right now. They just think that money is going to be coming out with no benefit whatsoever. There is a process in America. We hope that through a good process that we're going to be able to get a little extra funding from both the government on the state and federal level to help accommodate, to be able to insure ourselves. Again, $8,800 a month that we're quoted from Mr. Grover is an it's not a reality. $1,432 a month is what a level one Medicaid pays. That average, if you have a full house, is $7,200 a month. There isn't a whole lot to go with as far as getting health insurance when a private insurance policy is going to cost me $700 a month for me and my wife. It takes a lot out of the gross of what's left over to be able to provide for ourselves, which leaves us nothing for vacations. We've been taught through the state programs, through our education, that we have to be able to take care of ourselves on top of taking care of our residents. Take care of yourself. Well, without health insurance and some of the basic benefits, it is absolutely impossible to take care of ourselves. If we become sick, the only ones in our home that do not have insurance will be the providers, because the residents are already under Medicare and Medicaid. And that's why I'm here. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and the committee. My name is Fred Asa, and I came from Gresham, Oregon. Originally, I came from the Philippines. And my wife and I have been in the business of providing care for the elderly for over 10 years now. My biggest concern, well, first of all, the reason I'm here is because I'm in favor of forming the union. And one of the reasons why we would like to do that is mainly for representation. It seems to me, or to us and a lot of our care providers, that we don't get any voice. Whatever's being said by the from the higher-ups, from the county, from the state, we have no choice but to take that.
Fred, you know, I can get you to move just a little bit back from the mic because you're getting a little back feed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So basically I'm saying we are looking for somebody to represent us, because we from the Philippines, we have no idea who to go to. Even I would imagine the people from Romania would probably feel the same way. You know, we would like to have representation as far as pay. Right now, you have already received different testimonies. I have to admit that we are underpaid. as far as our Medicaid clients. We could hardly afford to hire caregivers so that way we care providers can have a good time or even go out. A lot of us can't even afford to do that. Another area, Your Honor, Mr. Chair and the members of the committee, is the area of insurance. The liability policy, just to give you an idea, last year I had to pay over $13,000 in liability policy alone. And I'm hoping with some representation from the union that we care providers may be able to bargain have a voice and get some kind of representation to possibly lower, get some better deals, better rates from other insurance companies. So basically that's the reason why I support the idea of joining or unionizing the care providers. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair and members of the committee, my name is Mosetta Zion. I'm a registered nurse, and I'm also an adult care home operator in Multnomah County as well as in Washington County. I'm before you today in favor of Bill 858. What I have found while I have been here in Oregon, since I've been here since 1999, that's when I was first introduced to the adult care home industry. I consider the industry to be one that is greatly needed in the state of Oregon. And I also believe that it is an industry that is needed throughout the United States. I believe that we set up a role model here in Oregon that works, except there are flaws. The original development of the adult care home program was set up with the mindset that each resident had to have a private room. That meant the adult care home operators went into financial disarray to make sure that every home that they had a private room for each resident. Not only that, the original design of the adult care home program had it that a person had to live in the home for 24 hours a day with the resident. So that included 5 bedrooms as well as 1 room for the care provider if the care provider was single. But if the care provider had family or anyone else, they would also have to have room for that family or any other person who lived in the house. So generally, the foundation of the adult foster care home required that you had at least a home that had at least 8 bedrooms almost. So what that did was it made the industry one to whereas you almost had to have private pay in order to make your bills, to make ends meet. What has happened is that private pay has become less and less available. You have people who have invested and signed contracts, 20 and 30 year home mortgages. And right now, since private pay is down and Medicaid is up, they're not able to fill their rooms, which means they're working hard hours. They're compassionate people. They went into the business to take care of people, but the original design was faulty. So what we're having now is people are in the business, but they don't have the benefits because they have to pay mortgage. They don't have the benefits. They don't have the educational training because the original design stated that you had to have at least 6 months experience taking care of an individual that needed assistance in activities of daily living. But it did not include that you had to have medication training. The adult foster care home industry needs redevelopment. To become a member of the union will only give us more say as to what we can bargain for. It will only give us the ability to bargain, to come together. I've been in Oregon since 1999. I've been in the adult foster care industry from 2003, and I have heard more availabilities of what they say are benefits just in this meeting today than I have heard from anyone. I do not know anything about how we can get insurance on our own, except for the time that I have tried, and it was unbelievable being a small business with two employees. I know myself that I have been a member of the union, working for the United States Postal Service, and also when I was working at the hospital as a nurse, as an RN. And the union only comes to the rescue when they find that labor laws or something is being violated. If the adult foster care home operators can come together, which by me sitting here today is showing me that they have failed to do so at this point. Because if they were able to do what they are claiming they could do, that should have been done. So I say to those people who oppose the bill that if those insurance premiums are available, if they can negotiate for us as adult foster care home operators to get better Medicaid pay for equal work, I'm saying, why has that not been done? Period. Why has it not been done? Why am I sitting here today? Why are you sitting here today?
All right. Thank you very much for your testimony. Any questions for anyone on the panel? Not seeing any. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, I want to thank everyone for being here today. As I told you, with the long list of people that had signed up, there is no way that we're going to be able to get through all the testimony. And I want to thank you for being patient, listening, and, let's say, staying within the bounds of excitement. Thank you very much.
Can I just make one comment? I'd really like to thank everybody that's involved in the adult foster care business. I just went through it with my mother-in-law, who was in an adult foster care home for a long time and then in hospice before she died, an aunt of mine. So people that are on either side of this, you are providing a great service. I've often said over the years that I think it's an indictment on American society that the people that we pay the poorest are the people that take care of our senior citizens and the people that take care of our small children. I think that's a problem. I hope we can address it. Thank you all for coming.